Good morning. We'll call the Senate Finance Committee meeting to order. Today is January 30th, Tuesday. It's a couple of minutes after 9 o'clock. We're in the capital city. Today we're going to be hearing from the Department of Health and Social Services regarding Senate Bill 144. We have the commissioner here with us. Can you approach the table and introduce who is assisting you either in person or online to answer questions of the committee?
Oh, I forgot. The committee member, Senator Olson, is gone on sick leave. Today we have co-chairman Senator McKinnon, vice chairman of the committee, Senator Bishop, Senator Machicki, Senator Von Imhoff, and Senator Stevens. With that, can you please proceed with your introduction of your team that will assist you in presentations and answering any questions that the Finance Committee may have. Commissioner?
Good morning, co-chairs Hoffman and McKinnon and members of the Finance Committee. My name is Valerie Davidson, Commissioner of the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services. Here with me at the table is Assistant Commissioner Shonda O'Brien. Sitting behind me in the room are John Sherwood, Deputy Commissioner for Medicaid and Healthcare Policy. Also seated behind me are Karen Forrest, Deputy Commissioner of Family, Community, and Integrated Services, Dr. Jay Butler, Chief Medical Officer, Monique Martin, Healthcare Policy Advisor, Special Assistant Aaron Shine, and eight division directors of the department are either in the room or on the phone. And they include Amanda Lofgren, Director of the Alaska Pioneer Homes, Randall Burns, Director of the Division of Behavioral Health, Margaret Brody, Director of Healthcare Services, Tracy Dompling, Director of the Division of Juvenile Justice, Tracy Spartz-Campbell, who is the Deputy Director of the Office of Children's Services, is available here in the phone to answer any specific questions about the Office of Children's Services. Christy Lawton, the Director of OCS, is also on the phone, but she has just returned from medical leave. So for questions today, Tracy will be handling those. Monica Windham is the Director of the Division of Public Assistance. Dr. Jay Butler serves double duty. In addition to being the Chief Medical Officer, he is also the Director of Public Health. And Dwayne Mays is the Director of Senior and Disability Services. And we're happy to provide our 2019 department overview. We will also be providing additional material or additional information over the next couple of days at the committee's request. So the Department of Health and Social Services was established in 1919 as the Alaska Territorial Health Department. And when Alaska formally became a state in 1959, our responsibilities were expanded to include the protection and promotion of public health and welfare. And those duties are reflected in Article 7 of the Constitution. These four links include our department's homepage and some helpful resource links for those who may be following along at home. Our constitutional authority can be found in that second link. The third link, the duties of the department, are really found in Title 47 of the Alaska Statutes in the third link, and the FY19 proposed department's budget are found on the fourth link. So these next four slides have been prepared by the Legislative Finance Division, and Assistant Commissioner O'Brien will be covering these slides.
For the record, my name is Shonda O'Brien. I'm the Assistant Commissioner for Health and Social Services. So the next four slides will depict the department's budget in a number of different ways. This first slide is our general fund budget only. It includes our designated general funds as well as the undesignated general funds. The comparison you see is a comparison from FY19 to FY 2009. The figures represented here are the management plan scenarios. However, with the governor's adjusted budget numbers, you'll see some slight differences over the years between the governor's budgets and then the management plan as it's implemented. The FY18 management plan numbers do not represent any of the supplemental requests that the department has submitted this year. So those general fund balances are lower than what our request is for right now.
And what was the supplemental request?
Mr. Chair, the supplemental request for the department this year is a $100 million general fund request for Medicaid. And then also $18 million in general funds for substance use disorder treatment.
Senator, excuse me, Senator Machicki.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Is the FY19 budget that we see here, does that include the $100 and roughly $18
million? Through the chair, yes, it does.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Machicki. Please proceed.
So this next slide is giving you a picture of the department's entire budget broken out by line item authority. Our department has been and continues to be largely funded in the grants and benefits line. The majority of our budget is spent from those lines. The remaining line items have remained pretty consistent and steady over the past 10 years, not a lot of growth or significant change that you can see from this chart. As you look at the detail below, you can see that there are some changes between several of those years as we've reduced some of our costs in the last 4 years, but then starting to see things grow again in the grants and benefits line. Slide five is a breakout of our budget by all of our divisions. This represents our general fund spend, again, only, which includes the designated general funds. Between FY 18 and 19, there's a large increase in our general fund request, representative of $127 million over FY 18's governor's budget. The numbers here, again, don't reflect the request for our supplemental. And then this final slide prepared by the Legislative Finance Division is slide six. Again, division budgets broken out by all fund sources. And so you'll see, again, between FY 18 and 19, a large increase in the Medicaid services component. That also does not include the RPL for $525 million that we received this year in Medicaid services for federal authority.
So the FY18 management plan to the FY19 management plan, as you pointed out, we see a substantial increase in Medicaid services. Were these anticipated a year ago?
Mr. Chair, they were. We anticipated some increase or some growth as a result of enrollment. As we developed and refined our projection tools, we were able to identify some other trending items that will help to support the requests and project better for Medicaid in the future.
And along those same lines, what does the department anticipate the trend lines to be in 2020 and the near future, 21 and 22, for this same line item?
For the Medicaid services in particular, we're anticipating that the enrollment growth is going to start to level out. As more and more people have become eligible for Medicaid or have applied and enrolled in Medicaid services, we're starting to see that those numbers in FY19 and forward will start to level out and there won't be as significant an increase in enrollment growth. We're projecting for FY19 the enrollment growth to decrease from what right now is about 12% to more in lines with 4% growth as we move forward.
And before I get to Senator Von Imhoff, is the department looking at ways, because if you looked at the previous slide, we've seen the program on a steady decline I think primarily because of legislation that originated in this committee. Is this trend alarming to the department, and do we anticipate anything to from the department and legislation to look at the program and compare it to other states to see if we are providing services that are above and beyond the norm in what many refer to as the Lower 48?
Mr. Chair, we do, as a department, review either current legislation at the national level and how it will impact the department and overall our spending in general funds, as well as the total spending in Medicaid. Also, there are ongoing efforts in the department where staff are reviewing information, reviewing claims detail on a regular basis to ensure that we are maximizing on our federal claiming potential. That work is ongoing and continual within the department. There are some specific efforts with SB 74 initiatives and reform that we've been also incorporating into that ongoing work.
Specifically in terms of legislation. Can the legislature anticipate anything from the administration regarding legislation? Maybe the commissioner might have a better idea on that.
Mr. Chair, the department isn't proposing any legislative change at this time. To answer your question another way, we are concerned about the significant growth in Medicaid expenditures. In FY 2015, Medicaid covered 160,388 Alaskans, and in 2019, we're expecting more than 225,000 Alaskans, unduplicated Alaskans, to be enrolled. We see that growth from several things in terms of enrollment. It's really attributable to the downturn in the economy. And if you look at our general fund spend, though, compared between 19 and FY 15, our general fund spend is actually less in the proposed budget for 19 than it was in 15. So thanks to the efforts of this committee through the Senate Bill 74 efforts, which you'll hear more about tomorrow, that has allowed us to achieve some savings. The other is we have been very aggressive in our refinancing efforts through the tribal claiming policy, which has allowed us to refinance how those services are provided to IHS beneficiaries who receive their care through an IHS facility. And I'm doing the quotes because that's what the national tribal claiming policy requires. Governor Walker was able to renegotiate that tribal claiming policy. It used to be that in order for the state to get 100% federal match for those beneficiaries, the services had to be within the four walls of the facility, physically within the four walls of that facility. It was a challenge for us with transportation, because transportation is to and from that facility. We made a request to CMS that they revise that policy so that travel for IHS beneficiaries was seen as a part of the service that was to be provided. They agreed. While we were at it, we also asked that services that began in an IHS facility and were referred to a non-tribal facility would also be considered 100% federal reimbursement for the state, because we saw that as a continuation of that service, and they also agreed with that. In FY 17, we targeted, I think our goal was $32 million in savings, in general fund savings in FY 17. We were able to save over $35 million. In the FY 18 budget, we are targeted to save $42 million, and we are on track to achieve those savings. There are, I think, over 700 care coordination agreements between tribal and non-tribal providers. One of the benefits we've also seen is that there's less duplication of service, and we've heard from beneficiaries that they are able to, and also from the providers, that they're able to do better health care planning because they know in advance who's coming and also who's going back, so that those services can be provided, the follow-up services can be provided in that person's home community.
I have a question from Senator Von Imhoff.
Followed by Senator Bishop.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So it's interesting you stated Medicaid increases due to a downturn in economy. I sometimes think it could be potentially aggressive enrollment efforts. I asked this last year. I'm going to ask it again this year. How many recipients are Medicaid recipients are also covered by IHS insurance? I think it would be interesting to see how many people are doubly covered. I didn't get a response last year. Hopefully, I'm going to get a response this year. Second thing is, with this uptick, my first thought, and particularly I think that we asked it in Senate Bill 74, is why aren't you using outside data analysis firms that specialize in statewide public health care analysis and reporting, that they have the most up-to-date software, they have done this for other states versus doing it in-house? To me, if this was, looking back on slide 6 and 5, when you see a big uptick like that, that would be my first inclination, is to try to get this data analyzed, how many people are going to the ER, for what particular ailment, how many people are seeing different physicians for different ailments, to find a look at a pattern. So I guess the question is are you using an outside data analysis firm? And if so, why or why not?
Through the chair, Senator Von Imhoff, I'm going to try and answer all three of those questions. So the first question, with regard to the number of IHS beneficiaries who are also covered by Medicaid, I think the question you asked was how many are covered by IHS insurance versus Medicaid. Just to clarify for the committee, IHS eligibility for Indian Health Service coverage or services is not an insurance plan. It is not an importable and a plan that you can pick up and take anywhere and use it. So it's different from insurance in that regard. About 40% of the beneficiaries in Medicaid are IHS beneficiaries or Indian Health Service beneficiaries. Or put another way, they are Alaska Natives or American Indians like me who are eligible to receive services in an IHS facility. Under federal law, those IHS facilities, including the tribally operated facilities in Alaska, are required under federal law to seek third-party reimbursement, including Medicaid, because of the fact that they are funded at less than or about 50% of the level of funding needed to provide basic health care for Alaska Natives who receive care through those facilities.
Mr. Chairman, could I follow up on that?
Senator McKinnon.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner, of the 40% that are on the Medicaid rolls, what is the total population that represents in Alaska? How many people are on or can qualify for IHS benefits? And then can we extrapolate that number out to be representative of the 40% that you're saying are enrolled in Medicaid? Am I being clear?
Through the chair, Co-Chair McKinnon, so Alaska Natives make up about 20% of our state's population, and 40% of Alaska Native, 40% of the Medicaid beneficiaries are Alaska Native. And so quick math for 2019, for fiscal year 2019, 40% of 225,000 is... I'm not texting, I'm just using my calculator function. About approximately 90,000.
Mr. Chairman, for clarity, then 90,000 Alaskans who qualify for IHS services are inside those Medicaid rolls, and that means about 146,000 of our total population is Alaska Native?
Through the chairs, Co-Chair McKinnon, I'm sorry. So of the 225,000 Alaskans that we anticipate to be covered by Medicaid or enrolled in Medicaid in 2019, 40% we anticipate are Alaska Native. So about 90,000 Alaska Natives in 2019 would be enrolled in Medicaid. There are many Alaska Natives who are not eligible for Medicaid simply because they do not meet the income requirements of Medicaid.
That point, do you have a follow-up, Senator McKinnon?
Mr. Chairman, I was trying to get the total population number for IHS recipients in Alaska, which if 20% of Alaska's population, that's what I was asking, is your 20% representative of all beneficiaries of Indian Health Services? And so if I'm calculating on a population of 730,000, I believe 20% comes up to around 14,600. I just want to know if those numbers are close to accurate. I can check with, I'll take that offline. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
No, I just, I appreciate the explanation. I think then the second part of the question is data analysis.
Through the chair, Senator Von Imhoff, we have some slides further that demonstrate how we arrive at the Medicaid projections. We have spent the last year really tightening up how we do that. And I think one of the reasons that you see the increase in the FY18 supplemental and the subsequent increase of about $27 million in 19 is because we have tightened up those projections. If you'd like, we can do that now. We can skip forward to those slides and then come back to this part of the presentation.
We'll get to them when we get to them.
Okay.
Further questions, Senator Von Imhoff? Thank you, Senator Von Imhoff. He wanted to pass. So, Senator McKinnon.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner, first I wanted to thank you and your team for the work that you do on behalf of the people of Alaska. Sitting at the finance table sometimes can feel a bit challenging for those that are at the other end of the table, and truly we're trying to understand the economic factors that are associated with the services that you deliver, and in these tight fiscal times, try to find ways to improve both our financial position in offering those services as well as the overall cost control. So please know that that I respect all that you and your team does on behalf of the state for the people of Alaska. The health industry is growing in a time where Alaska is experiencing the some of the highest unemployment rates in our nation. The health industry is being purported to be a shining star inside of that environment, in that numbers for employment are up. And I just have to ask, and the question is begged, who is propping up the growth in that service?
Through the chair, Co-Chair McKinnon, healthcare growth, you're right, the cost of healthcare has increased throughout the country, not just in Alaska. Really, everybody plays a part in that cost. So in our state, the largest payer of healthcare services in our state include private insurance, including our state covered lives through retirees as well as active employees, through Medicaid, through folks who pay for private insurance. We certainly have heard from not only this committee, but also members of the public, that they are concerned about the rising medical costs throughout our state, which are mirroring what's happening in the country. This administration has convened a group of folks, including membership from from OMB, from the Department of Administration, from Commerce, Community, Economic Development, which includes the Division of Insurance and the Department of Health and Social Services, to look at how we can contain some of those costs. I think the challenge we have is with the state being, in our state, quite frankly, the largest purchaser of healthcare services, we want to make sure that by saving costs to the state budget, we don't unintentionally shift those costs to folks whose health care is not paid for by the state.
Senator McKinnon.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As I understand it, the state of Alaska or government entities are paying for in Alaska better than 50% of the overall premiums that provide insurance. Is that fair?
Through the chair, co-chair McKinnon, I believe that's correct, but the Division of Insurance is within the purview of the Department of Commerce, Community, and Economic Development. And I don't want to create a problem for my counterpart over there. What I can say is that I should just stop there, because I know that they have really done some incredible stuff for market stabilization for the individualized marketplace plans. One of the things, getting back to Medicaid, though, I know that one of the reasons that we anticipate that one of the challenges that we have with increased enrollment has also been the requirement for the individual mandate, because folks knew across the country that if they didn't demonstrate that they had some kind of coverage, some kind of health care coverage, that they could potentially face a penalty when they paid their federal tax. And now that that individual mandate has been removed, we are expecting that we may see some folks not wish to continue that coverage.
Senator McKinnon.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We're still projecting growth in those numbers overall, at least according to, I believe, what you've presented to the committee today. And earlier in our dialogue right now, you stated that the rising costs in Alaska are mirroring the rest of the country. Is that factual? Because my understanding is Alaska receives reimbursement 30% higher than any other state in the union, and maybe that any other state isn't accurate, but we receive 30% higher reimbursements than other states.
Through the chair, co-chair McKinnon, I apologize if my comment wasn't clear. Alaska, what I meant to say and convey to the committee is that Alaska is experiencing growth in the cost of health care just as other states are. In terms of the payment for the provision of services, the charges in Alaska generally are higher than they are in other states.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I've heard conversations in the halls of the legislature that this administration, not specific to your department, but including your department, is ignoring the legislature's intent to try to control costs and hold down the operating budget, and that there is great consternation starting to gather around the supplemental budgets that are being presented to the legislature this cycle in reflection of past cycles where supplementals are basically off the table and never counted against the FY18 budget or against the upcoming budget. And so we're taking a portion of our budget basically off budgeting period and using supplementals to force the legislature into paying for cuts that they may have voted to include in past budgets. Can you tell me how the department will deal with a supplemental that is not funded this year?
Through the chair, co-chair McKinnon, I certainly haven't been provided a directive or a nod and a wink from anyone in the Walker administration that it is okay not to control our costs. We certainly have those conversations about efficiencies. They are a agenda item in every cabinet meeting that we have with the governor. I would describe our conversations with OMB as quite vigorous and robust, not necessarily in a fun way, if you get my drift. In terms of the increase between the 18 supplemental, we were very clear with the legislature last year that at the appropriation level in 18 that we anticipated a supplemental. As we made our budget presentations in 18, we knew that we were going to have a supplemental just because we knew that the budget was not going to be able to, was not sufficient to be able to meet our federally mandated requirements. Did we anticipate that the 18 supplemental would be that high? No, we did not. Our budget request for FY19 specific to Medicaid is what we believe at this time is a true representation of our FY19 Medicaid need. I will definitely acknowledge that there is sticker shock, not only around this table, but certainly reverberated throughout the department and certainly throughout the administration. I won't count the number of sideways glances I get in cabinet meetings because of this budget increase, but we also want to be to provide a clear picture of what we believe the FY19 budget request should be to be able to meet what our anticipated need.
Senator McKinnon and Senator Machicki.
Mr. Chairman, just I asked, if the supplemental is not funded in this year's budget, what will be the course of action for the department?
Through the chair, Co-Chair McKinnon, I'm sorry, I misunderstood your question. So the FY18 supplemental of $100 million can be reduced by $7 million because the federal, we included $7 million in supplemental for the Children's Health Insurance Program, a national program, which in our state is called Denali Kid Care. It had not yet been reauthorized by the time we put our budget proposal together, including the supplemental. That has been reauthorized, so that $7 million can be taken off that amount. But the short answer is, if we don't receive the supplemental to be able to pay for our FY18 expenses, we are, by federal and state statute, required to pay those claims, and we will have to suspend claims toward the end of this fiscal year 2018, and then begin paying them in 19. But that's going to cause a problem for us also in the 19 budget.
Senator McKinnon.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I don't mean to belabor the topic, but it's a huge cost center in our budget, specifically on GF. So I appreciate the answer. I want to circle back around and see if you could provide me possibly a written update on your Medicaid claims and enrollment numbers, and then say that I passed a note to my staff asking if I could get the general population number for Alaska Natives and American Indian numbers against the entire population. And so if we use the 2017 numbers based on the previous census numbers, we have a population of about 739,000. And in 2016, Alaska Native and American Indian represented 15.2%, which would mean that inside of Alaska's population, there is approximately 112,000 folks who could qualify for Indian health services. And if you're telling me then that 90,000 of those individuals are on Medicaid right now, there are only then 22,000 about Indian Health Service qualified recipients that haven't been migrated over into Medicaid services. And why that is interesting to point out is because Indian Health Services is a fixed pot of money that is provided to Alaska for this particular population. But Medicaid is an unlimited amount. And when we look at the federal government and we talk about $525 million worth of federal money that is not included on this particular slide, as well as the increased spending that we see as we've been cost shifting over to the federal government in this department heavily, which has benefited us in the short run, our nation is struggling with enormous debt at upwards of exceeding $18 trillion. And so I'm afraid we're setting ourselves up for a fall with this heavy reliance on federal funding. I understand why we're doing it. I just want to make sure that we've pointed out for the record that we are susceptible in big ways to changes in funding from the federal government. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator McKinnon. Senator Machicki.
So we're all part of the same team, and we've got to do this together. And I know it doesn't feel that way sometimes, but I just wanted to put it in perspective a little bit, this $500 million increase in total spend with $100 million UGF is the budget of some departments. And for you, it's a supplemental, right? And that supplemental is 250% over the potential that we talked about. We talked about possibly being in the $30-40 million range last year. We're at 127 or 117, depending on how you calculate it. Now, just the reason that's important is at this table, we also have to fund education and roads and law enforcement and everything else. And we work hard. We've worked hard to bring down the cost of this government. And it's kind of a one fell swoop thing, right? We put all the hours and time in to try to manage that. And in one fell swoop, all those cuts are eliminated. And it's after we leave, and it's frustrating. So I'm one of those that shares that challenge. But when the administration requests, a little kind of bit off topic, but not really, because you talked about this, as we shift the burden, when we talk about taxes, we're talking about shifting the burden from employed non-covered Alaskans to cover the Medicaid population to the tune of $100 million supplemental. We have to talk about changing who is eligible, reimbursement rates, and what is covered. And if that requires legislation, we need ideas from the department. I will make the statement that is often made, and Senator McKinnon makes it all the time. We believe in accessibility to health care for all Alaskans, and I'll say that as many times as possible. But we have to qualify that statement. My family manages cost in health care, and I often tell the joke of what it would take to take my kids to the doctor, right? I mean, we're a healthy young family, and we just don't utilize those services very often in our own private plan, as well as the state plan that we're in, just being members of the legislature. So it's time for that conversation. We simply can't manage the growth. So I'm looking for ideas from the department on those areas of what we can change to keep this funding flat.
Do you have comments from the commissioner?
Through the chair, Senator McKinnon, I appreciate, I'm sorry, Senator Machicki. Sorry, I was looking at Senator McKinnon. I'm so sorry. And going back to your comment and also an earlier comment by Senator McKinnon, it is hard to sit at this table, I think in your seat as well as ours. These are unprecedented times for our state. The downturn in the economy has resulted in more folks enrolling in Medicaid than we anticipated. And we are getting the increase in general fund has really been for regular Medicaid beneficiaries. And we still, in the FY19 proposed budget, our UGF spend for Medicaid is less than it was in FY15. So while the sticker shock between 17 and 19 is there, it is still less than where we were in 15. But we would be happy to work with the legislature and this committee in particular on other ways that we can work to contain the costs of Medicaid.
Mr. Follow-up?
Senator Machicki.
Thank you. I just we often say we talk about the current state of the economy, and we talk about having the highest unemployment rate in the nation. We essentially always have the highest unemployment rate in the nation because of the seasonality of our employment. We are down 0.1% of typical. So I think we have to think about what actually sends someone to enroll in Medicaid. And that's one of the things that we have to evaluate is, are we being aggressive in enrollment? Because the change in the spend is not reflected in the slight increase in unemployment. So I'm having a hard time making that connection.
Senator, before I go to Senator McKinnon, the problem back in FY15 was that we had a $4 billion deficit, and we are trying to manage the state's overall budget. The budget now is north of $2.5 billion, and that is still not sustainable. So to say that we are below a number in 2015 when the deficit was $4 billion wasn't acceptable then. The level of state spend today is still unattainable, and we need to look at tightening our belts as much as possible before the state of Alaska goes bankrupt. You know, that's the reality of the situation, Commissioner, and this committee, probably more than any other committee, has that understanding, and that is why over the last 5 years we have been looking at reductions in many different programs statutorily and through the budget process. And that is one of the reasons that we are looking at this huge $500 million growth, because to us it seems as though we made major strides in trying to get all of the budgets, not only the HES budget, other budgets, down to where we can someday in the near future have a sustainable budget. And to see those hard-fought reductions being eroded by a growth in the department's operating budget in one fiscal year is quite frustrating, I think, to this committee and to other members, I'm sure, to the other finance committee, because we are certainly not out of the woods. We are looking at trying to get a structured draw out of the POMV, a lot of other things, but in no measure of the word can we say that what happened and where we were spending money at FY15 was acceptable. That is why we spent the long hours over the course of the last 2 years to try to get control or move in the right direction. And today, that is why you're seeing the questions here. We're moving in the wrong direction, and we are not. And even if we were sustainable last year, having $100 million growth causes me consternation, and that is why I asked, is there discussion at the administration's level to look at this level of services and what is eligible and what is not eligible in the state of Alaska, and compare that to what other states are doing? And I think that the administration should take seriously that question. The deficit with the structured draw of $2 billion still leaves north of a $500 million deficit. And I know Senator Bishop says that he is not interested in, if we gave a structured draw, not interested in trying to continue to have an unstructured draw above whatever comes about as a result of Senate Bill 26. And that is, I think, the frustration that you're feeling today from all members of this committee, including myself. Senator Bishop?
Thank you. I do have a comment. Thank you. I got a disclaimer first. I haven't been feeling on the top of my A game, so if I really say something stupid, that's my excuse, okay? So now we know we don't have a $100 million supplemental going forward, because you just showed us a $7 million cut. Correct?
Through the chair, Senator Bishop, that's correct.
Okay. All right, so now we can talk about a $93 million supplemental going forward. So, and that's an anticipated $93 million going forward to get you through the rest of 18. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Senator Bishop, that's correct.
And if it's the chair's could have a little latitude if the chair thinks this is worthy. I would just like for the committee to see where the anticipated $93 million is going to go to finish out the year in 18, because, you know, you didn't arrive at that number willy-nilly, and I'd just like to see where the budgeted expense is for the $93
million. I think we're going over that tomorrow or in the next few days. I think that's going to be addressed in the next couple of days. We still have two more days, unless you want to give some overview of that.
Through the chair, Senator Bishop, we can provide you that breakdown. The other thing we wanted the committee to know is that later on in the slides, actually shortly in the slides, maybe even the next one, we're going to, maybe the next several slides, we will provide information about the data sources that we use to be able to calculate our Medicaid spend. We shared this information with Ledge Finance, and they suggested that we also do a training for anyone who's interested in digging into the detail of how we arrived at those numbers, and we would be happy to invite any members of the committee or your staff to who would like to participate in that as well. But if I may say, we share the committee's concern with the growth in Medicaid, and I want you to know that this is not something that we take lightly. It is not a pleasant thing to be sitting before this committee requesting that large of a supplemental. We're trying to be, we're trying to project as thoroughly and as honestly as we can where we think our spend is going to be, and we look forward to continuing to work with this committee to help contain our Medicaid costs.
Senator McKinnon.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. When I asked for the update, I believe I used the word slide for the Medicaid claims and enrollments. It's actually Medicaid claims and employment. It's part of our year budget summary document, and that's what I'm looking for an update on. This was this has FY16 numbers in it, and if we could see the FY17 numbers for backup, that would be helpful. And then, Mr. Chairman, just one question. I know that I believe currently we're paying, when you set Medicaid benefits, we're statutorily, we've set it at 150% of the federal poverty level. Is that accurate, Commissioner?
Through the chair, Co-Chair McKinnon, Medicaid eligibility really depends on the population and the category of folks who are served. And so, for example, Denali KidCare, who are children, our Children's Health Insurance Program, the effective federal poverty level eligibility is 208%. The federal match for that we receive, that the state receives, is 88%. So I should let the committee know that as a part of the Affordable Care Act, there was a change to how Medicaid eligibility is determined across all of the eligibility categories. And it is now based upon modified adjusted gross income, with a couple of exceptions. It used to be that we counted, did you, the value of your home, if you owned a home, the value of your car, did you have a boat, etc., which was administratively really challenging for every state. And now, with a couple of exceptions, those are now based upon modified adjusted gross income. So for CHIP or Denali KidCare, it's 208% of the federal poverty level. For pregnant women, which covers prenatal through a six-week checkup, these are women who are covered by virtue of the fact that they're pregnant. The eligibility is 205%. The federal, for a federal, 205% of the federal poverty level, the federal match for that is 50%. For elders and folks who live with disabling conditions, the eligibility is based upon SSI, and that federal match is 50%. There are folks, and these are all federal federal categories.
Senator McKinnon.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You gave us the 50% match on the disability or senior, but what is the rate of poverty? You said 205% for pregnant women. You said 208 for children, but you didn't give us that for the disabled.
Through the chairs, Co-Chair McKinnon, my apologies. For that category, they are eligible by virtue of the fact that they are enrolled in SSI. It is not based upon their federal poverty level. So it is basically a medical determination. So you can be medically qualified for Medicaid. Parents
at that point, Senator Machicki.
Yeah, actually, on that point, so if someone is an author and earns a very healthy income doing something else but remains disabled, there is no line of income, they are still qualified for Medicaid.
Through the chair, Senator Machicki, as long as they meet that disability requirement, they can be medically qualified for Medicaid under federal law.
And does that disability requirement vary among states, or is that a requirement that is a national standard?
Mr. Chair, that is a federal requirement. It's a national standard.
Thank you. On that point, Senator Manema?
On any of the lists that you just cited, is there, you have the federal requirements, but I also know that there is flexibility within the state to maybe adjust within a range. Has the state of Alaska adjusted any of those rates based on federal guidelines, as in are we pegged to the far right or left in any one of those?
Through the chair, Senator Von Imhoff, the only place that has changed is with regard to Denali KidCare or our state children's health insurance program. Our federal poverty level standard in Alaska was 200%. It then dropped down to 175% at the legislature's direction, and then the legislature again increased that to 200%. Because of the way that the modified adjusted gross income, though, works, and the kinds of income that we have to disqualify, the effective rate is 208%.
We do have 2 days, Wednesday and Thursday, that are dedicated to Medicaid cost drivers and reform updates to get into more detail. We're on page 7, which is about a third of the way through the process. So if we can, any questions that are related to Medicaid cost drivers and reform updates, maybe we can get to them. Senator McKinnon?
Mr. Chairman, the reason I asked the first question on understanding what's on our books statutorily versus what we're actually paying was a question that I'd like the department to at least disclose, if not today, then later, and think about. And that is, are we federally required or are we not allowed to actually quantify the benefits that individuals are receiving? So can we issue a 1099 or something similar to a 1099 for Medicaid, for food stamps, for, I think on a previous slide you gave us a list of benefits that we are sharing with the people of Alaska. Can we do something like a 1099 to outline those costs to the state that are being provided in benefits to the people? And again, Mr. Chairman, I can get that answer later so we can move on.
Thank you. Thank you, Senator McKinnon. Commissioner, please.
So there are a couple of additional ways to be able to qualify for Medicaid, but we can cover those in the more specific Medicaid program. Moving back to slide 7.
For the record, again, this is Shonda O'Brien. So we didn't really get into any discussions on slide 7. We put this slide forward because it's a comparison of all the governor's budget scenarios from FY15 through FY19, broken out by fund source for the departments. More or less a representation of where we're really seeing the largest amount of growth in the department's budget is in the federal funds that we receive. Slide 8 is our Medicaid budget, broken out the same way. You'll see on here, the very top of each of these bars is a very small black-looking line that represents our funding that's either designated general funds or other funds in the Medicaid program. The majority of our funding is in federal, which is the gray section of the bar chart that you can see, and then the lowest area of the bar chart is our general fund budget for Medicaid. Slide 9 is a population comparison to enrollment. We used population data from the Department of Labor. The enrollment data going back to 2000, you'll see at the very bottom, the green shaded area of the bar represents regular Medicaid enrollment. And then as we start to see in 2016, the yellow section of that bar chart is our Medicaid expansion enrollment. And then what we've projected those enrollment figures to be for 2018 and 19. Slide 10 and 11 will cover how the department is doing Medicaid projections. Prior to this past year, I think we used a couple of different methodologies of which I'm not entirely sure of. So I can speak to what we're doing now, which is we use trending analysis, and as was requested earlier, we do use an outside agency. We have a contracted employee who does trend analysis for us. He's been on staff with us via a contract for several years, and he takes a lot of the data that we have in our system and does do that long-term forecasting analysis using how we're spending, how we're claiming, adjustments to the spend based on some of the refinancing efforts that are underway. And he gives us a combination of either long-term forecasting trends, which tend to be less accurate for budgeting purposes, and then also a short-term forecast, which gives us a comparison that we use against internal analysis that we also do. The internal analysis, we tend to look at more of the finite details, where we're looking at actual payments being made, how much of those payments fit into the different FMAP categories. We trend them out based on straight-line projections, which basically take how you're spending now and project what that would be if you continued spending that way, and then also apply what we know to be other factors in the Medicaid projection process, which are the refinancing efforts where processed claims will come back through the system and be reprocessed at higher FMAP rates, and where we're seeing growth and what we can anticipate to continue to see in those growth areas. For example, assisted living home growth might be a category of cost that we see an increase in or a spike in, and you know, who that population is. We look at, you know, what's driving those cost anomalies to the detail and dig in deeper to try and understand, is this going to continue? Is this a trend that we should expect to continue to see? Is it due to a backlog issue? Is it due to pent-up demand? And so a lot of those factors are what go into the department's analysis and the straight-line forecasting that we compare to the economic information that we receive from our analyst. So Commissioner had mentioned that we are in the process of setting up a meeting or a training. We're kind of framing it more as an open discussion whereby people can come and meet with the department staff in our agency and have an open conversation to ask questions about those specific details that go into the projection process. What we're looking at, some examples of where we've seen growth, some of those service areas of the state maybe And in doing that, we would walk through what we call our stamp report. So on this slide, you'll see there's a stamp report that stands for the short-term Alaska Medicaid projection report, which is the forecasting model that takes into account the economic situation and labor data and other things. And then also, like I had mentioned, our auth report is what we refer to as our straight line projections. It takes our weekly check rate detail, breaks it down by how claims are processing, how much of the claims are reimbursable at higher rates versus others, and then also takes into account the reprocessing FMAP rates.
Mr. Chair.
Senator McKinnon.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On slide 11, Evergreen Economics, is that who presented the original analysis on the expansion for the legislature? And if so, I recall that slide deck presentation where there were estimates of enrollees, and I'm wondering how accurate Evergreen Economics was during that conversation. Is it consistent that we're using someone who provided us good information, or was the variance a larger swing?
Mr. Bryan.
Through the chair, Senator McKinnon. So we can get you I can take a look at that report and see if what was presented previously is on track with where we're seeing things now. We do know that there are some other things that have happened. The economy, I believe, was maybe not what it is now. The information that we provide to our economist is really valuable to whether or not his projections are accurate. One of the things that I realized over the past year being new in this position was that we weren't sharing all of the information with the economist that made his projections as useful as they could have otherwise been. And so we've addressed that internally. The information that we're sharing with him is more in depth. It includes more detail than what he was previously seeing, so that those projections that he's using now are taking into account the refinancing efforts, other factors that are happening in the department as far as how we're reprocessing claims to get the higher FMAPs.
Senator McKinnon.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If I could just get a follow-up, I'm remembering a specific slide in that slide deck that calculated TRICARE employees as well as Alaska Native Health recipients, and I believe the number was in the tens of thousands. It wasn't to the extent that we're looking at those numbers today. And the only reason is I just want to, you're absolutely right, numbers in versus numbers out is going to be critical to have good information going forward. But I'd like to see what those numbers are for military qualifying for our Medicaid program also. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator McKinnon.
I just have one follow-up question.
Senator Von Imhoff.
Thank you. So this particular slide, the question that I have, you have IRS actual monthly expenditures. I think the more meaningful piece of information for analysis is the diagnostic codes. So are those being given to Evergreen Economics as well?
Through the chair, Senator Von Inhofe, they are. He's getting all of that detail, the codes from the system, as well as any of the adjustments that go into the claims processing piece. And so he's got more than maybe he's ever had in the past as far as how he's being utilized and what analysis he's providing. And he's also working very closely with the person who is responsible for a Medicaid reporting. And so that individual is working with those numbers on an ongoing basis. It takes about 6 weeks for the Medicaid report to be prepared and finalized for CMS, which is done on a quarterly basis. It's about 600 pages, and the staff who are responsible for that work are in the detail and working with program staff and getting questions answered about why we're seeing different things and fact-checking information to make sure that it's accurate, because sometimes there are things that happen in the system that may not be accurate. And so those conversations are constantly in play, as well as making adjustments and corrections when they become aware of something that's not correct.
Senator Von Imhoff.
Thank you. So I think it would be nice to know how much are we paying on an ongoing basis to Evergreen Economics for this service,
and when the Senate might be able to see a report, and not 600 pages, but a nice executive summary that includes some pretty graphs and analysis of those graphs so we can see exactly what you're finding. And then the follow-up is what you intend to do to address the findings that you're seeing, meaning we're going to allocate more money towards this large line item that's taking up the lion's share versus we may reprioritize some of our behavior and allocation due to the findings that we're having. So, again, I'd like to know how much we're paying for Evergreen. This is, and I'm writing this down, you don't have to answer this now, when the Senate might see a report, a summary report that includes your analysis of what you intend to respond and prioritize based on the findings. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Von Imhoff. Please proceed, Ms. O'Brien.
So the next set of slides from 12 through, I believe, 23 or 24 are individual breakouts of our budget changes from FY15 through FY19 and also include some interesting detail about either the division and some of their challenges or how we've made changes throughout the years to efficiencies and savings. This first slide on 12, on page 12 is the department level summary. So this will just tell you the overall changes across the department between FY15 to FY19. The total budget increased by $582 million. The undesignated general funds are still at a decrement of $91 million over what was budgeted in FY15. We've seen an increase in some of our designated general funds. The other category, which is interagency receipts and some other fund sources, and then the largest growth is $634 million in our federal authority.
This is very interesting, but we're looking at 18 to 19. This makes us look, makes us feel a little bit good, but
so the summary, Mr. Chair, the summary is the FY15 to FY19, and below you'll see detail about what our supplemental request is. As we mentioned earlier, the $100 million in UGF for Medicaid services is anticipated to be reduced for the CHIP reauthorization of $7 million.
Mr. Chair, if I may, just to address your question, the top part of each of these slides is the change from 15 to 19, but the bullet below is the change from 19. The change from 18 to 19. Yes. I apologize, we didn't make that clear.
Thank you.
Slide 13 is our Alaska Pioneer Home budget changes. Overall, the division has sustained a decrease in UGF spending for $3.2 million. We've seen some increases to their other funding categories. The increment in FY19 of $525,000 in federal receipt authority is due to an increase in the Veterans Administration's rate for per diem. They're increasing their rates, almost doubling them effective 10-1 of this current year, so we will receive more federal receipts from them for those costs. Slide 14 is the Division of Behavioral Health. They have sustained a $16 million decrease in UGF from FY15 through FY19. The most important, I think, one of the things that we've seen with costs in behavioral health have really been cost drivers for the Alaska Psychiatric Institute. Of their budget makes up 1.95% of the department's total budget, and of their staffing levels, the Psychiatric Institute has the majority of the staffing in that division, and so in order to keep our patients safe, and address safety issues in that institute, we have a large staffing level. A lot of overtime goes into those costs, and it can be a significant cost driver for them.
If I may add more to the API history, Mr. Chair, when API was first opened, I think in 1965, 2 years before I was born, it had approximately 220 beds and increased bed capacity to 225 beds by, I'm sorry, opened in 1963, by 1965 had capacity of 225 beds. Nationally, there was an effort to deinstitutionalize Americans, people who lived with disabling conditions, to get them in a more appropriate home-like setting. At the time, it was when the state was planning to build a new API facility, which definitely was needed. The consultant's analysis indicated for our population that a 124-bed facility was probably appropriate at that time. When API opened in 2005, at one time I think there was a proposal to build a 40-bed facility. The compromise was reached to build an 80-bed facility. But at the time, the consultants indicated that the need was for 124 beds. 40 of those beds would have been designated for forensic beds. And right now, based upon those 80 beds, rather than 40, we have 10. The pressures of API, we've certainly seen them, heard them from our constituents, from Alaskans, so we have certainly seen that pressure in the news media. But I think we can all agree that anytime you change a business model from a capacity of 225 down to 80, when the need that was identified was 124, doesn't matter what line of business you're in, we can expect to see some challenge. We've done our best to meet that challenge. I do want to underscore, as Assistant Commissioner O'Brien mentioned, the JCO work that's happening right now, the renovation, we are going to be down 10 beds. That's happening right now. And then the second phase of that will be later this year, later in calendar year 2018. So API is encountering and some additional pressure from that as well.
Thank you, Commissioner. Ms. O'Brien.
Slide 15 is the Office of Children's Services budget. Their budget makes up 5.04% of the total department's budget. They have a total of 565 positions. Since FY15, they've increased in staffing levels by a total increase of 65 positions. In FY17, they've reported that their protective services reports were the highest ever documented at 18,000. What we're starting to see now is that there are more discharges happening than are children coming into custody. And so one of the things that are attributed to that, we believe, is that they have more adequate staffing levels to address more of the permanency issues and getting children into permanent placements or back at their homes.
Senator Bishop.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. That's a disturbing number, really. I mean, it draws a correlation with the Criminal Justice Commission's report on when you look at the percentage of violent crimes when they're perpetrated against children. I mean, this is kind of matching up with their data, and that's a travesty. We as a people need to do something to fix that.
Thank you, Senator Bishop. Ms. Bright.
Excuse me. Slide 16 is the healthcare services budget. Their budget is 0.67% of the department's overall budget, and they have 127 positions. Overall, they've reduced staffing levels by 7. They have a decrease in their overall UGF spending of $1.7 million. They're asking for an increment in federal claiming for the FY19 budget, as a result of some increased claiming potential in their administrative costs. Slide 17 is the juvenile justice budget. The juvenile justice budget makes up 1.8% of the department's overall budget. They have 468 positions, and since FY15, they have reduced staffing levels by 34 positions. The funding for the NOMU facility is in the base of the budget, and they're currently working right now to implement some recommendations from the privatization feasibility study to transition four of their 14 beds to long-term treatment beds. So that's kind of an exciting thing for them.
If I may add one. I'm sorry.
Thank you, through the chair. So I'm just looking at the pages and seeing a pattern that DGF, designated general funds, it seems to be increasing in each category. What are the sources of these funds, and are they sustainable over the long term?
Through the chair, Senator Von Inhofe, the designated general fund categories are varied across each of the divisions. So some of them might be for program receipts that they receive for fees, or sometimes program receipts are things that we receive in the way of rebates from the feds, for example, like with the WIC program. We see a lot of variance depending on where we are able to collect those receipts. So, for example, in the Office of Children's Services, their designated general funds are largely made up of receipts that they get from the Department of Revenue for child support services and SSI benefits for kids in custody. Those fund sources typically have been sustainable. They've been able to collect almost the full $5.6 million that they have in designated general funds over the course of the last couple of years. What we're seeing this year is that the child support receipts have not been materializing. We're not getting as much child support money into the system. So in most years, you'll see some fluctuation depending on the source of those receipts and maybe what's happening. And what we're understanding from the Department of Revenue with regard specifically to OCS is that there are either more people who aren't working and we're not able to collect on child support, or they believe that maybe the size of the PFD may have contributed slightly to the ability to collect those receipts for OCS.
Senator Von Imhoff.
Thank you. So I'm hearing that there's a lot of variance. A lot of it depends on federal government programs. It's unpredictable year after year. And the last couple years, you've seen a decrease. And so essentially, what I draw from that is you don't know whether it's sustainable. You don't know what's going to happen in 2020 or 2021 because of the variability and unpredictability. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Senator Von Imhoff. We have a pretty good understanding of what we should expect to see. A lot of the detail comes into which division, what the receipt sources are, and whether or not there are some extenuating circumstances, such as I mentioned with the Office of Children's Services. Not in every case is it going to be as varied as that. That's kind of an extreme example of where we see excess authority. Typically, when we have excess authority sitting on the books that we don't have any reason to believe that we're going to collect, we decrement that authority out of the budget. It doesn't make sense to keep it there. So when those longer-term trends take place where it's happened year after year, that's a good time for us to take a look and see whether or not it's necessary to decrement those funds or do a fund source change, depending on what we would need to replace it with.
Senator Von Imhoff. Thanks, Senator Von Imhoff. Senator Bishop.
I just wanted to just briefly note for people listening at home and in the audience and for the record, we see a common theme throughout this whole presentation, and it goes back to the economy and it being able to work and make a living wage so we're not on these 200, you know, so we're not using the services, you know. And the other question is, how many people out there are working two jobs that could probably qualify but won't qualify, that don't want to qualify? There are those out there too. So it's the economy. We need to work as a group. to make sure that we don't stifle economic growth in this state and keep those good-paying jobs. Thanks.
Thank you, Senator Bishop. Senator Machicki.
This is kind of more philosophical than anything, but I'm just wondering if eventually, as this thing eats us alive, as you say, it's kind of a common thing in each state, and by definition of the combination of fund source increases, that's the way I see it. I think eventually, out of D.C., you're going to see changes. And I feel like we're setting up an entitlement or an expectation for a level of service that we simply can't provide as a state. So do you recognize that as a very realistic? I'm sure you sat around as the ACA conversations were occurring this fall, this summer. That's real. How do we get in front of this so that we don't get handed a giant bill because we simply can't provide these services? There, even if you had a very aggressive income tax, which I don't support, the reality of it is you don't have enough earnings in the state of Alaska to cover these costs. So what's the plan for the possibility of things heading in that direction?
Commissioner.
Through the chair, Senator Machicki, you are correct that we, the Department of Health and Social Services, spent a lot of time this summer, and over, it seemed like they coincided with every major holiday, all of the various versions of the Affordable Care Act changes that were being contemplated by Congress. We were in constant communication with our congressional delegation and at every opportunity, provided them information about what the impact of those changes would be to our state. And we were just very factual here, based upon the change in the Better Care Reconciliation Act versus the various versions. I sort of lost track of how many different versions that were going through. We just said, here, based upon the way that this program would be set up to a block grant program or a capitated program, the impact for the first 7 years to the state of Alaska in loss of federal funds would be this. Based upon this nuance, if you made this change, that change would be this. Under all of those scenarios, those changes were pretty significant, not only for Alaska, but also 49 other states who participate in Medicaid. Certainly, they heard every state, every senator, and every member of the House in Congress heard from their respective states about the impact. And I think I can fairly say that they decided not to proceed with that action. You're right, that is something we are monitoring very carefully. There does not seem to be the interest to do a wholesale repeal of the Affordable Care Act any longer. And in terms of federal funding, there does seem to be federal funding available for other programs, which are things that help Alaska as well. For example, military spending continues to increase, which is something that is actually very helpful to our state. You're correct that we were very involved in the Affordable Care Act analysis and provided information to our congressional delegation about what those impacts would be.
Brief follow-up?
Yes, Senator Machicki.
Yeah, I think I clearly stated I don't support an income tax because I see it as a shift, and I think it's becoming easier to need these services in the U.S., but eventually there will be a day of reckoning as our $17-18 trillion federal deficit continues to grow as our own state's deficit is at the point that it's at today, as Senator Hoffman says, north of $2.5 billion. And we compromised on that number a little bit. The reality of it is a day of reckoning is coming, and the state of Alaska cannot be holding the bag, and we cannot expect those that are making it to be responsible for those that are struggling. And, of course, I'm never talking about those that are truly disabled or, seniors or those that have no other way But we have to increase, like Senator Bishop said, our focus should be on the economy and then getting people to their full human potential for their own personal success so that they don't need, that a much smaller proportion would be on these services. And I just worry, seeing the numbers grow when, again, the increase in unemployment has just been an incremental increase, it worries me for the long term.
Thank you, Senator Machiki. Senator Von Imhoff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just would add, and I guess to build upon what the previous senators, all of us are saying, is how would you restructure the department and how would you prioritize programs in the event that a significant change in federal funding occurs, regardless how we're going to bend the cost curve that we saw in the previous slides with a large jump in funding. So you stated that you worked all fall and said if the funding occurs, these things would happen. What are those things? And what is it that you are doing and your deputies, everyone in this room, is doing to help meet that challenge so we can still maintain affordability? So restructuring and prioritization.
Through the chair, Senator Von Imhoff, like every other state, we are required to meet the requirements of federal law. And as those changes were being contemplated by the Affordable Care Act, and we provided information to our congressional delegation about what those changes would be, we certainly did our best to provide what that breakdown would be. These are how many folks who live with disabling conditions would be impacted. These are the number of children who would no longer receive health care, et cetera. The same could be said for many of our public assistance programs. Most of our public assistance programs are actually federal programs that the state, implements. There are a couple of exceptions. There are some exceptions under public assistance for which there is no federal requirement. Those include general relief. It's fully state funded, but we also use that for our maintenance of effort for being able to get federal match for our Medicaid program. Senior benefits are also fully state funded. That sunsets in 2018. And then again, senior benefits that are used for SSI recipients also count for our maintenance of effort for another program as well. There is one state program, the Alaska Heating Assistance Program, that was also fully funded and it was eliminated in FY16. But the other programs in public assistance, for example, SNAP, the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, the benefits are federally funded. The state receives some funding to administer that program. Alaska Temporary Assistance, as I mentioned before, meets, it's a part of federal requirement. We use it to meet the maintenance of effort. Adult public assistance, also a federal requirement. We use that for maintenance of effort requirements. Heating assistance, federal heating assistance, as opposed to the state heating assistance additional amount I mentioned earlier, is also a federal requirement. The Child Care Program Office is a federal block grant with some general fund allowed for state administration of the program. And WIC, Women, Infants, and Children, is also a federal program that provides nutritional foods to pregnant and nursing mothers and children up to 5 years of age, and that is also a federal requirement. So one of the challenges that we have in our budget, which we haven't said very clearly until this moment in time perhaps, is, you know, the vast majority of our budget is actually federally mandated entitlement or formula-based programs.
Thank you, Commissioner. Please proceed, Ms. O'Brien.
So as the commissioner was saying, the public assistance program, which is on slide 18, the budget for public assistance has been reduced by $35 million in undesignated general funds. Public assistance makes up 9.19% of the overall budget in the department. They have 556 positions and have reduced overall 9 positions since FY15. The funding for the senior benefits program was added into the FY19 budget. That program is due to sunset this year. The Division of Public Health, their budget makes up 3.6% of the department's overall budget. They've reduced their general fund spending by $16 million. They have 426 positions in the division, and they have reduced their staffing by 65 overall. We are seeing as a decrement in the budget this year to the designated general funds for the tobacco use education and cessation funding of $375,000 as a part of our multi-year plan for sustainability of that fund source. The Division of Senior and Disability Services makes up 1.9% of the department's overall budget. They've reduced their general fund spending by $5.2 million. They have 175 staff total. They've increased their staffing level by 2 overall. This year in their budget, they have reorganized several of their grants components into a single component so that they could administer all of their grants in a more efficient way, reducing administrative inefficiencies and being able to have a more fluid process for issuing grants.
If I may add to that, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, if you look at the budget books, you'll see it looks like there are 166 employees in senior and disability services in the category administration. They're not actually administrative support functions. Due to the size of the division, as Assistant Commissioner O'Brien mentioned, a lot of those staffing were consolidated to a single budget component, so they include in that category protective service specialists, health program managers, medical assistants, administrators, and nurses. And of that 166 that are in that administration category, 10 are actually true administrative support staff, including the director.
Thank you, Commissioner. Ms. O'Brien.
Slide 21 is the Department Support Services budget. This is our general administrative for the department, and it includes several other areas such as IT, our facilities, staffing, and our capital budgets. In the past 5 years, you'll see that we've reduced the general fund spending by $9 million. The Department Support Services makes up 1.3% of the department's overall budget. There are 222 staff. Over the past several years, we've reduced staffing by 48 positions. In the FY19 budget, we transferred 16 of our IT staff over to the Office of Information Technology with the Department of Administration. We've also decremented some excess federal authority out of one of our components, and we'll be eliminating that component from the budget in subsequent years. Slide 22 is the Medicaid services budget changes. We've seen some of this same detail in other slides. The overall decrease is $1.8 million in general funds. The increase is the federal funding of $617 million. In the department's FY18 supplemental request, will be, as we've mentioned before, we'll be seeing that $100 million in UGF decreasing by the CHIP enrollment or the CHIP reauthorization of $7 million. You'll see that our federal authority has increased in the FY19 budget significantly over other years. We are anticipating that we'll start to see things level off. As I mentioned previously in other slides, the enrollment, we anticipate enrollment will start to level off, and we won't see as large of an increase as we have in the more recent year. One of the areas of the Medicaid services that we have some information on is our current waiver services. are an alternative to the institutional services, which are mandatory. And in FY17, the department spent $242 million on waiver services. They make up 12% of the overall Medicaid budget.
Mr. Chair, before we move on from this slide, a question we often get asked is the category of Medicaid mandatory versus optional services. And under Medicaid, it's federally authorized and state administered. And state Medicaid programs have the option to provide some services for adults, hence why they're called optional services. There really are no optional services for children because children must receive effectively all optional services under the EPSDT program or early periodic screening, diagnostic, and treatment program. So they are effectively mandatory. We actually have 24 optional services that are available for Alaskans. Has happened over many years. The reasons those optional services, as we've presented to the committee before, are provided because they are a cheaper, they are a more cost-effective way of being able to deliver another kind of service that might be considered mandatory. There is one on that list that is podiatry service that we don't actually cover, but we are required to pay the Medicare cost share for that for folks who are duly enrolled in Medicaid and Medicare. So a person who's 65 or older qualifies for Medicare by virtue of their age, but also is low income and also qualifies for Medicaid. We call those folks duly eligible. The top four optional services that we have seen that we pay for in our budget are prescription drugs. So the pharmacy benefit, we cover that simply because states certainly have found that if we don't provide those prescriptions to beneficiaries, they generally can't afford them and they don't take them. Doesn't take very many medevacs if you just consider even one category, like high blood pressure, somebody has a stroke or heart attack, doesn't take very many medevacs to be able to compensate for that, and emergency services are considered a mandatory service. Other services are...
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner, you just talked about pharmaceuticals. Can you tell me how many opioids are included in the number?
Through the chair, Co-Chair McKinnon, we can get you that information. There are, we have, as you know, as a state, have really taken a look at the number of opioids that are prescribed through legislation that was passed by this legislature, introduced by the governor. Providers are now limited in the number of first-time prescriptions that the number of days of opioids that a first-time recipient of, let me start over.
Commissioner, I'm aware of those parameters. Yeah. I was, the question is specific and not that your team needs to go research it, but can you give me any input on pharmacy prescriptions that we're filling under Medicaid? In large ways, what does that look like for opioids, and is it another way that we can help intervene in the opioid crisis for the state of Alaska? Are we providing these drugs at no cost, basically to individuals who have conditions that may not need the opioids but are more in the pattern of addiction versus helping with pain management or something else?
Commissioner?
Through the chair, co-chair McKinnon, we can get you that information. Our biggest cost increase, one of our biggest increases for prescription drugs have been for things like drugs for Hep C, hepatitis C. Thank goodness, there is a new drug available on the market. The cost for treating hepatitis C used to be $60,000 to $80,000 range, and that cost is now down in the $20,000 range. So that is, thank goodness, a step in the right direction. As those prescriptions that have been expensive turn to generic. When those generic opportunities arise, we certainly seize those opportunities. But specifically to your question, we can get you that information. But that also provides a nice transition for the other optional service that's available to our state that we take advantage of, our behavioral health optional services, which includes treatment services, and it also includes mental health services. So, obviously the more folks we can provide treatment to lessens our cost over time. Personal care services are also a service that we provide as an option because providing that care in a person's home is a much cheaper option than providing that as a mandatory service at a skilled nursing facility. And so we can provide you more detail to the committee and answer your question in writing.
Thank you, Senator Machicki.
Yeah, actually, just to follow up, is there a reason why, or can you explain to me why the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority is not the one picking up the $18 million increment to the UGF budget? Is that they've invested fairly heavily in substance abuse treatment? Is that not the right place, considering the endowment?
Through the chair, Senator Machicki. We did not have conversations with the Mental Health Trust about that effort. They prepare their budget in advance of the department preparing our budget, so the process is already established, and when they've completed their budget preparation, that's when we begin our work on the department operating budget. But those conversations weren't being had with the Mental Health Trust when the supplemental bill was being prepared.
As chairman of the subcommittee, maybe you might want to look into that, Senator Machicki. Senator McKinnon.
Mr. Chairman, I was just going to point out that I know that those at this table know this, but the state cannot tell the Mental Health Trust how they are going to spend their money. There is a specific parameter of options that we have based on things that they do need approved through our budget, and I'm sure Senator Machicki can get to the bottom of a conversation about some of that. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator McKinnon. Mr. Bryan, please continue.
Slide 23 is some highlights of the capital budget request for the department. Most of our requests are in the Office of Children's Services, and then also for some mental health programs. The Office of Children's Services is requesting a capital budget of $1.2 million in which they're going to use the funds to increase safety in some other field offices where safety is a significant issue. They've seen an increase in situations in which their staff are being threatened, and so in order to address the staffing safety issues, we're asking for this capital request. The mental health program equipment requests, those are funds for buying snowblowers and kitchen equipment and therapeutic equipment for the majority of the funding. Here, let's see, it's half of it is mental health trust funds, and then the other half of it is the AHFC funds, so no state general funds are being spent on those. And this is kind of a common request we have most years. And then the final is the modification upgrades to maintain housing so that folks can stay in their homes. We pay for different modifications for ramps or supported housing, mostly for people with special needs, and really it's an effort to keep folks in their homes as long as we can, or to help sustain their independent living. And then the last two items are the Code Blue services, and then the Pioneer Home renovations and repairs of $2 million in UGF funds. The Code Blue project supports community purchases, essential emergency medical response equipment, and the Pioneer Home renovations are for the Anchorage Pioneer Home. to provide additional capacity for individuals with Alzheimer's disease and related dementia and complex behaviors. We're seeing an increase to the number of residents that have these kinds of conditions, and then also for the Ketchikan Pioneer Home.
Slide 24, we really appreciated these questions that were provided to the department in advance. We've tried to incorporate these throughout our presentation. The first one was the major cost drivers, and we highlighted those throughout our presentation. And as we mentioned before, the biggest cost drivers are in Medicaid, the Office of Children's Services, and the Division of Public Assistance, because those are all formula programs that we are required to comply with. We were also asked about the cost to advertise various social programs, and folks were wondering if the ads that they're seeing in the movie theater or on buses, et cetera, are leading to our increased enrollment. And the advertising for that the department participates in are really largely paid for with federal funds, and they're often a requirement of our federal partners. Some examples of the areas where we pay for that advertising are the WIC program, Women, Infants, and Children's Program, are paid for with federal funds. The opioid advertisements were paid for with federal funds. Play Every Day is also paid for with federal funds. There are some advertisements for open enrollment or those kinds of activities that we were asked to participate in as a department, and we declined those opportunities simply because we don't have the resources in our budget to be able to pay for those. So whether it was Protect Our Care or an advertisement on a bus encouraging folks to sign up, those funds did not come from the Department of Health and Social Services.
Can we just have a brief at ease, please?
Stand at ease. Call the meeting back to order. Commissioner?
So there are some programs that we have used state funds for advertising. For example, when marijuana was legalized in our state, we were very concerned that the only messages that young people were hearing is, woohoo, pot is legal in our state. And we thought as a public health agency, we probably should get another message out there. So we did some advertisements. There was like a cartoon ad that made sure that young people knew the dangers of marijuana, the effects that marijuana had on young brains, and also provided notice to the public of where they could and could not partake, and that driving under the influence was a no-no. We were also asked how Alaska's social services programs compare to other states. And in other states, this one is a little bit tricky. Other states really provide a lot of their services through their counties. They provide county health programs, et cetera. So it was a little bit hard to do some of those apples to apples comparisons. But as we mentioned before in our presentation on or a slide on public assistance, our federal programs really abide by those federal guidelines. Some are adjusted for higher cost of living in Alaska, so we may have a higher federal poverty level standard that is set by the federal government. I mentioned some of the unique Alaska programs earlier, the heating assistance program that was specific to Alaska that has since been discontinued. The third bullet, the money spent per recipient per capita on social services programs, a breakout by community. I think this, as we understood this question, are we spending more per capita in Alaska than other states are per capita? And we weren't sure if you were looking, for example, that all citizens benefit from public health activities that benefit all Alaskans versus information that was to a specific program or a population. And with more clarification, we're happy to get to that level of specificity.
Senator McKinnon.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner, you and I had a conversation that we specifically described what we were looking for, and I don't think it's reflective of your comments. What I asked for was by program, which you listed some of the programs, where each of these assets are deployed, by cost center to try to keep the data separate, and I've been asking for that same information for about 11 years. So I've only been disappointed for the last two that I haven't received it from this administration. And it's not to penalize anyone for accessing the care. It's to try to manage where the assets are being deployed to try to understand the data surrounding the regions that might be involved in receiving multiple benefits. So if we can do that by district or by region, I was using the region because our tribal organizations also participate in healthcare and help the populations that they represent. But if it can be broken down by individual districts so that we could see Senate districts of how many people are receiving food stamps, as an example, which goes back to my question earlier, is there a way to issue a statement of benefits to a family about the cost to provide all of these services to those families, whether it's federal dollars or state dollars? That's certainly a breakdown that can continue further into that conversation. But knowing the people that are accessing the services and how dependent they are on the state to provide for their livelihood enters many policy discussions about equity in our state. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
And Co-Chair McKinnon, my apologies. I thought I understood, and then I clearly didn't understand, and I think I understand again. We did provide a separate handout for public assistance that shows how a person may qualify for different programs. I think you're also interested in the dollar amount per program, what their eligibility might be, and then by legislative district.
Senator McKinnon.
Certainly where the asset is being deployed is important, and that we would understand that there are different regions that have higher unemployment rates and poverty that would incline them to qualify for more benefits. But in addition to that, there are families that coordinated care may need to be deployed into if we actually look at all the programs that they're qualifying for. It's been asserted before with and unsubstantiated that now we have new numbers that are saying that the federal income rate is about 208%, maybe the average versus 150% of the poverty line of all these individuals that are qualifying for services paid for by the state. Senator Machicki said it, Senator Von Imhoff has said it, Co-Chairman of Finance has said it, Senator Hoffman, that we can't continue to supply these services at these particular costs, and how do we analyze them to make sure that we're delivering what we can for those most in need? And so we deliver programs, and how do you connect them to families so that we can look at how much a family is receiving from the government? Are they receiving $70,000 worth of benefits? Is the only folks that are at 150% of poverty level able-bodied men and women that could be working somewhere that can't? Because the list that you gave us seemed to cover everyone else except those who could go get a job.
if a job was available, depending on your region, which I look to the Dillingham area and Senator Michicki's comments on seasonal work and know that the fishing industry has a very high employment rate in the summer but may have a low employment rate in the winter. So our state is challenged with many different issues, and it goes to Senate Finance really wanting the data to be able to extrapolate what is happening in our state, but specific on this request, where and who are we funding at a higher level, and how can we quantify that so that the folks that are accessing care understand the costs that the state is picking up on their behalf.
Commissioner.
Through the chair, co-chair McKinnon, I appreciate the clarification.
Mr. Chairman, last follow-up.
Senator McKinnon.
Mr. Chairman, can we get these answers in writing just so that we can provide them to those that are asking the questions back at home that are contacting their legislators and with these particular questions?
Do you want to continue with the verbal presentation or get them in writing? Because I was going to ask for if other members, we are going to spend the next 2 days on Medicaid cost drivers and reform updates, and I would request that if there are any other questions that members may think of between now and 5 o'clock, that we can get them in writing so we can provide them as well to the department. So in writing would be fine. With that, we are approaching 11 o'clock. We've been here for 2 hours. Is there any additional comments that members of the Finance Committee would like to make before I ask the Commissioner to give her remarks?
Just a brief one, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Michicki.
Thank you. Department of Health and Social Services, you have a very valuable role. It's one that we share. We have additional roles in funding this government. I talked about that earlier. If you look at $2.671 billion in total funding for the department, and you divided that by recipients of 200,000 or so, you're looking at a $14,000 per capita benefit. I mean, there are different ways to break it out. We can break it out in a lot of different ways. That's family of six on a per capita basis. It's $80,000 worth of benefits. And if we, 14,000 times six, I'm just making it a rough estimate. We live in a state where less than half of the folks work. I'm wondering if it's time for work requirement, training requirement, something that helps people to reach their potential. And I don't mean that in a cruel way whatsoever. I want everyone to succeed. And I think if we make it easy to not succeed, and with expansion, although those are working individuals, I think our state has increased the availability of benefits that make it easier to not pursue their dreams. It's the way I see it. We may not agree. But my primary reason for speaking is that the Department of Health and Social Services has to be a partner, an active partner in reducing these costs. And we cannot make these benefits available to everyone. We certainly can't look for new recipients. And we hope you'll join us in helping to bring the rolls down and manage the cost on a per capita basis.
Thank you, Senator Michicki. Commissioner, do you have any closing remarks before tomorrow?
Oyanda, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we share the committee's concern about the growth in our programs. We also, like the committee, members of the committee, appreciate the value of the services that we provide to Alaskans. We see a lot of these services that we provide to Alaskans, whether it's healthcare or whether it's a public assistance benefit, as a way to be able to get people back on their feet. And we are required by federal law to have a number of work and employment and training opportunities available, and we're very proud of that work, and we're happy to provide some of those examples to the committee. We certainly know that people can't work, they can't hunt, they can't fish if they're not healthy enough to do so for their family. We work with folks every day to try to get them healthy enough to do so and work with them through public assistance, through our training, education, and employment programs to get folks back on their feet.
Thank you. With that, we've been doing things a little differently last year and this year. We're having the four major cost drivers. We've had DOT come forward to present their budget to this committee so that all the committee members can get a better understanding of the four major cost drivers, and so we can make the better budget decisions. We have the university and the Department of Education still to go, but I would like to say that the chairman of the subcommittee for the Department of Health and Social Services is Senator Machicki. Members on that subcommittee are Senators Coghill, Senator Giesel, Senator Kelly, and Senator Olson. They will still be going over and making their subcommittee recommendations before this full committee. But tomorrow and Wednesday, we will be having hearings here at 9 o'clock with presentations on Medicaid cost drivers and reform updates. With that, we will stand adjourned.